UIC. I also have a joint appointment at the Institute for Environmental Science and Policy. And I also, because I typically get bored, I also have a third position, which is the director of the Urban Data Visualization Lab at UIC. And I have a little bit of a mixed background. I started out as an ecologist. So I did my undergraduate degree in Argentina as an in ecology. And then when I was working and studying ecosystems, and I came across a concept of complex systems, and it was really intriguing to me. And so this idea that ecosystems could be understood as these systems formed with different kinds of components, plants, animals, etc., and within biophysical cycles as well. But that they had a trajectory, that they had a history and a behavior. And so I thought, well, this is a very interesting mindset and framework to use to understand how these systems can change as well, and thinking of complex, of sustainability and such. And when I graduated, I went to work in a consulting firm, an environmental engineering consulting firm in Argentina in the 90s. The only token environmental scientist, the only woman, for that matter, in that environmental engineering firm. And so I came with all these ideas of complexity and sustainability and recycling and all of that. And they were like, yeah, it's very interesting. Let's just keep doing what we know how to do. And so it was a little bit frustrating, but that is what essentially motivated me to come to the United States and study urban planning, which has a different meaning in Argentina. It's more about urban design. Here, it's really about managing urban systems and making decisions within these urban systems. And I ended up at the University of Michigan because they also had this Center for the Study of Complex Systems. And it really allowed me to look into, how do we use this framework to understand not just ecosystems and the environment, but also cities and the way they work, because they're also complex as well. So my work, essentially, if I had to summarize it, has been about this idea of, just understanding our world as a complex system, and then how do I use that framework and the tools within that framework to try to inform decisions. And so my motivations, started actually when I was 16. So, and by the way, some of the people here have already heard some of these stories, so I'm sorry if you're hearing them again. But essentially, when I was 16, I wrote in my physics books, I remember, I, Moira Zellner, will be an ecologist. As I always say, needless to say, I wasn't the most popular girl in high school. But I always had that, that motivation of these big questions and these big issues that, this was back in the 80s, okay? And these were things that we were talking about. So, the fact that also as an ecologist, I understand that we live within biophysical limits, hence my questions and my pressing on the issue of growth, right? The fact that there are those limits, that my concern from the environment, that we have these persistent problems like, droughts, air pollution, etc. We've had them for a long time. Still, despite all our advances in technology and also in social organization as well, we haven't really made much of a dent in terms of addressing them, of solving them. Okay, we're still dealing with the same things and maybe even more complicated than before. So a lot of my work has been about trying to address and resolve these questions with modeling tools. And I focus on I'm not going to show you all that work here, but a lot of the work has been on trying to investigate some of these assumptions that we make, especially within planning, about certain aspects of what is sustainable. And that was going back, I don't remember who was asking, but what is sustainable? And it's, it could be different things for different people at different times. But sort of, for example, one of the questions was about, one of the discussions was about defining a sustainable urban growth pattern. And, what is a sustainable growth pattern? And so I created a model that essentially linked land use and land cover change with groundwater flow to try to see, can we investigate that, or can we determine if there are any such thing as a sustainable urban growth? or the green infrastructure, and it's, you know, effective for, say, flood, stormwater management and flooding. But, well, you know, how effective is it, and under what conditions? Or, you know, like, how do we try to couple, like, these different scales of goals where there's these local economic interests to grow, but there are also these regional environmental goals or limits at the same time? And I've not only worked on urban issues, I've also worked on rural issues, and say, for example, managing flooding and drought in agriculture. And so for all of these, I created models. So in the rural areas, it was also groundwater flow and land cover, like cropping decisions, zoning for the urbanization models, and so on. So I just created these models that would couple human and natural systems, trying to represent explicitly these different actors, infrastructure, environmental processes that are present in these coupled systems to inform decision making. And so I'll give you an example. How many people are familiar with agent-based modeling? Can I see a show of hands? Oh, so quite a few. Okay, so I won't have to explain a lot of it, but I just wanted to give an illustration, especially for those who are not familiar with this kind of approach. So agent-based modeling is a computational modeling approach where you represent actors of different kinds, and it could be like people who are making decisions, like residents that you're going to see here, but it could also be countries, it could also be municipalities as they make different kinds of decisions, and they interact within an environment which includes other entities and other actors. So here, what I'm representing in very simplified form is an exurban area with the bright green showing, you know, high ecological quality, and the center showing here, like, first, say, like an office park or a mall somewhere in the exurbs as, you know, development is started. And as I run a simulation, what I see is residents that are coming in, they're looking for, they have preference for here, they trade off between proximity to urban amenities that are essentially represented in these red squares, but they're also pursuing green. That's why they're going to exurban areas, right? Kind of like what's happening in Texas, maybe. And so the thing is that they feedback on each other because these commercial centers also follow where the residents go. And so each history might be a little bit different because, again, what happens in complexity is that history matters. It's path dependent. So early patterns of development then will affect what happens in the future. But in general, if we had to characterize a pattern, it's not very different. What would make it different, however, would be if people had different preferences. So say that they don't care, now residents don't care about being close to service centers. Now the pattern that emerges from that interaction between the landscape and the residents with each other is very different. So they're now, you know, just grouping around these areas of light green because that is all they care about, right? But what happened if we add another feedback? And now whenever there's development, we have environmental degradation. What do you think is going to happen? So what's going on here? Essentially, I have the same preferences. Nothing has changed in terms of what the residents prefer. But they have this spillover effect that now they're deteriorating the environment, and as they deteriorate the environment, they're making the place like not as good for other people who are starting to have to move out like further and further and further out to get what they're looking for. And it ends up with what? With a very different pattern, all spread out, which has all sorts of problems for infrastructure and an environmental degradation overall. Okay, so these are the kinds of tools that here you see it kind of like as a toy model, but we can adapt these to specific regions, actually, to try to look at the interplay between individual preferences, regional conditions, and the feedback effects. To come up with, let me change here back to here, to come up with answers to some of the questions that I was posing. And so, you know, I published a whole bunch of this work, and again, like, you know, why I asked the issue of growth? Because growth is not sustainable, period. Okay, so part of the modeling, the work with the modeling that came out is that, you know, we've got to understand that there are biophysical limits and we cannot grow beyond them. We have options within those limits, but we cannot grow beyond them. In terms of green infrastructure, it doesn't always work. There are certain conditions under which it won't work. So you've got to be aware that there are spatial interaction effects, that there are thresholds to be met, and so on. There definitely can be collaborative conservation under development pressure, so you can actually, there are instances in which we can find opportunities for collaboration at a regional level, even when we have this development pressure at local level. And then in terms of like some of the rural things that I was looking at, adaptation seems to be really good to reduce crop losses, but they tend to exacerbate flooding. And so these are some answers that just came out of some of the research that I was doing. But again, even though, you know, there were answers and I was doing all this, I think, great work, there was very little uptake. And what I thought about, and this, I started thinking about this back in 2008 or even earlier when I was doing my dissertation work, is that part of the problem is that, again, we've got this separation between where science happens and where policy happens. And they're two different worlds that they talk to each other, but often also talk at each other or past each other. There's very little integration here. So what happens is that we've got stakeholders in their own realm, in the policy realm, that have their preferences and goals. Usually those goals are related to growth, because that's what we think we need for economic development and other things. And so those demands are then become scenarios, essentially, for the scientists to, you know, model. And because this activity has to be neutral and objective and unbiased, and I'm saying all of that in quotation marks, then we've got to create these very complicated models so that they can be accurate and predictive, because that's the emphasis, like what's going to happen in the future. And the problem is that because they become very quickly black boxes for anybody else to inspect beyond the modelers, whatever comes back to the policy realm is just these estimates that come out of the modeling, but not the assumptions, not the values that go into building these models. And so here we lose an opportunity to adapt and innovate and have discussions about the goals that are driving the modeling itself. So the goals are established in a different world. And the problem with this is that we cannot understand how our goals drive the problem unless we understand the inner workings of the system that we're in and where the problems arise. And so if we want to do policy, we need to, and you know, informed policy, we need to be able to understand the system and its inner workings. And that just never happens in this setup. It just cannot, it's not set up that way. So when I was starting my dissertation and doing this work based on a model similar to the one that I just showed to you, I was on groundwater issues. I was working, you know, like around the issue of agents, and how they make decisions, and how they draw water from the aquifer, and so on. And I was sharing that as I was developing that model with the county planners. And when I was doing that, I realized that it was easier to communicate with them by showing them the model and the interface and the agents coming in and how they sucked out the water and all of that, and how the cones of depressions were being formed, and et cetera. And so it really made me think that we really have to think of this, and this is part of the conversation, it's been part of the conversation. Remember, this was, again, back in 2008. Now we're 10 years later, over 10 years later, so this is becoming more of the norm, I think, or where we want to go. But where models become these boundary objects around which we all, the policymakers, the scientists, the constituents, we are all stakeholders. So going back to what was said earlier this morning, right? We are stakeholders too. And these boundary objects help us investigate, jointly learn about the systems, inspect and question and negotiate our assumptions, our goal. We jointly learn, and it gives us more opportunities in an iterative process of collaborative learning around these modeling and different kinds of visualization to learn together, to innovate, to come up with solutions, and to adapt, because things change. So we need to do this on an ongoing basis. Now, this is all very nice, but it's not easy. There are many challenges to this. So on one hand, you know, we always, you know, even amongst ourselves, and we're used to interdisciplinary work most of the time, okay, but it's still hard. And we were having this issue of vocabulary, and what do things mean to different people, right? But we also see it like when we're dealing with public officials, for example, and like their own assumptions on how the world works. And I have plenty of stories that I can tell you at another time, where there's like, again, like people talking at each other because they're not understanding and they're not synthesizing the information that's coming from different sides of the spectrum of, you know, public versus maybe research or academic world. Spatial thinking and computer modeling is still hard, even though we've got like lots of gadgets and things like that. You know, I know enough to be dangerous on many of these things, and many other people do as well. So it's a hard thing to do. The other challenge, which is my favorite one, is confirmatory bias. And what that means is that, you know, I can have the best model in the world, but if whatever the outputs of the model, whatever the outputs are, if they don't match what, you know, you think is going on, you're going to think my model is crap. Okay, and it could be the best model. And then I can have the worst model in the world, but if the outputs align with what you believe in, you're not even going to question it. Right? I mean, we do that. So that's another problem to deal with. And then the other, the last one that I think is important is, as at least in planning, it's this, what I consider an overemphasis in consensus building. And the problem of that is that if our goal is to agree, probably the only thing we're all going to agree on is something so vague and general that it's useless. Okay? We start to disagree as we go down into the concrete, right? And the concrete, I don't mean the concrete, the pavement, but the, you know, the concrete stuff, right? So like, what do we do on the ground? And that's where the disagreement is. And so if our goal cannot be consensus, because we're probably not gonna agree. And I'll get to that in a little bit, but the problem with then generalization that comes with that. So then this shifted my work into other kinds of questions, which is, how can complex systems modeling help us learn about the complexity that we deal with? And then how does this learning lead to better decision, better deliberation, and then decision making? Okay? So I'll tell you the end of the story first, and then I'll tell you the story. So what we learned is, first of all, I did not do this work alone, of course not. I paired up with people from a bunch of different disciplines. And I think that the most productive collaboration was with the learning sciences. So I did collaborate with biologists. I'm not dismissing the biologists, the computer scientists, the engineers. They're all wonderful people. But because I was looking at this as a social learning set of questions, we have at UIC a Learning Sciences and Research Institute, and I reached out to them a little bit serendipitously. But, you know, it was one of the most fruitful collaborations I've ever had. And I think that it's a discipline that needs to be integrated into whatever we do here. And so we created this platform that would support the integration and collaboration in learning and planning in a social learning process of trial and error. And what we saw was, we saw evidence of learning and policy innovation, but it was really hard. And the problems were that, first of all, again, as I said before, complex systems modeling is hard with any tools that you have, okay? So there are tools that facilitate it, but it's still hard. But I think that the most problematic aspect was that, you know, when you model these things and then you get outcomes that don't align with what you think, and usually what you think is gonna work is kind of like an optimistic thing, and then you see that it doesn't work, then it just leads to this doom and gloom. And because you realize, oh, shoot, like we thought these solutions were going to address a problem and they don't. So there's this dissonance, which was really exciting to us, like, wow, they're learning. And they were all depressed. And so what's the point of learning if what you're learning is going to depress you to the point of paralysis and denial? We don't want that either, right? We want people to be motivated to act. So this is a very human experience. So that's why I'm saying it's not about big data, okay? Because it's, even when we use big data, it's really, we have to go back to the fact that this is about human decision making. It is a human activity. And computers here are only a prosthetic device, okay? They're not a replacement for human judgment. There cannot be, we still have to be the ones making decisions. And so when we design tools and approaches, we need to support this very human activity. Okay, so I'm going to share two stories. on the progression towards like this platform that actually earned us an American Planning Association Award, the first American, no, sorry, Academic Tech Innovator Award in 2017, and how we got there. So this work started in Northeast Illinois, so this is Chicago, and we worked on some exurban areas where part of the issue is with, you know, both, well, we started with groundwater supply. And the issue there, like even though we have water all over the place, actually the exurban areas rely on groundwater only. They cannot tap into the Lake Michigan water by law, okay? So they're restricted from that. And guess what? They're running out of water. And we started this back in 2009, and we were trying to carry this message. 10 years later, they didn't do anything, and now they're like freaking out because in 10 years, there's not gonna be any more groundwater, okay? So it's not just, you know, arid regions. It's these regions too. What we did is we came up with a progression of meetings in which we engaged stakeholders from the very beginning. That, you know, stakeholders who were concerned about the groundwater supply into the a modeling process where we brought them along in developing the models with us. Okay, so we didn't go in and just come up with a model for them. We wanted to develop it with them, okay? Because the assumption was, well, they'll be part of it, they'll trust it, they'll be able to open and inspect all assumptions, and we'll deliberate and so on. So we started with something like very simple, like what I showed you before, and you know, just to explain how preferences lead to specific patterns, and how when you change preferences, you can lead to different patterns. And then we added this other layer of groundwater flow into it, and just so that they could link then the preferences to the patterns, to the cones of depression that might arise, and how, you know, you might start having like really huge drawdowns where the houses are brown. We started adding figures, like the kinds of graphs that they wanted to see of what interested them, so the drawdown, how many, the area in deficit, the households in deficit, and so on. And then bringing in the geography. And so that kind of looks like the area that we were looking at, and like, you know, using different colors to show, well, those areas depend on Lake Michigan, but all these other areas are going to be running dry. And so just kind of like showing all of that. And what we saw was that there was evidence of learning innovation, but there was also a lot of resistance. So on one hand, yes, the assumptions became very transparent. In fact, some people were saying, oh, there's no growth here, so we don't have to worry about that. But as we were building the model, they were like, no, actually there is growth here, here, and here. So making it explicit helped them actually question and revise some of their assumptions. Mental modeling was really cool to see. So people were starting to understand how water would flow and how urbanization could affect it, could affect the groundwater levels. And they were starting to look at different scenarios, and even before putting it in the model and running it, they could anticipate, because they started to understand groundwater flow, they could anticipate what the effect would be. Especially in relation to, you know, if some communities were to tap into Lake Michigan, what would happen? But again, coming across the issue that the favored solutions that they thought would work were not going to. And so like really having that sense of like, wow, we thought this was gonna have such a huge impact and we're seeing that it won't. And really thinking, okay, but then what do we do? Well, they, in this particular group, they thought they could isolate themselves from their neighbors and all the growth that was gonna happen around them. They were no growth, but all the other, you know, around them were, and they thought that they could still protect their water. And then they saw, oh no, okay, so what are we doing here then? What do we need to do? So becoming really more specific about solutions, like, well, I guess we need to, you know, do we create these giant recharge areas? Well, maybe we need to work with our neighbors, which they hadn't wanted to do, okay? Or it also allowed for some people to voice some solutions that they were kind of shy about. They thought, like, I would never say this in a public meeting, but how about well water injection and things like that? Okay, that brings a whole host of other problems, right? But at least they were able to bring that up. But yet, there was this idea that, you know, it didn't work. They rejected the whole thing after we did like a series of meetings with them, you know, progressively informing the model and stuff. They were saying like, well, you know, this is not very accurate, okay? And I'm not sure this was useful. So we're like, you know, floored, like after all of that, and like you learned guys so much, you know, and no, they just didn't want to take it. So we started thinking like, okay, what happened here? So one of the things that we did, and this is work that was like in the beginnings. I don't have the work that Dan Mills, but Dan Mills really took this forward, this methodology. And he's got more publications on this. But essentially what we did is that every meeting that we had, we videotaped everything, we transcribed the dialogue, and we coded the dialogue to see two things. One is the kinds of observations that they were making, so the kinds of comments that they were making. Were they objecting, or agreeing, clarifying, you know, what were they doing? And then about what? What was the content that they were talking about? Was it the world? Was it policy? Was it, you know, different things? So here, each one of these rows is each one of the four meetings that we had with one particular group. And we've got the pink shows when they were talking about the model, purple when they were talking about policy, yellow on process, red on the use of the model, and then green on the world. And what we wanted to see is that they would shift, say, from pink, which is the model, and really asking questions about the model, to talking about the policy and the world, which are in purple and in green. And here we're kind of cheating a little bit in the first session, because yes, we were presenting the models, but then we had a discussion about the policies that they thought would work. Okay, so that's why you see so much purple and green. But in meetings two and three is where we really started working with, like, you know, the progression of models with them and trying to explore different policy scenarios. And we see here, like, here we introduce the model, we talk a lot about, you know, the model itself, a little bit about the policy in the world, but we have more of that discussion as they explore with this model together. Meeting three was like the best one, where again, like, what would happen in between these meetings is that we would take their feedback and put it into the model and then come back with a new version. And so again, a lot of clarification, but then really having a lot of rich discussion about, you know, what would that transfer into the policy in the world. And so what was happening in all of this progression is that they were asking for more and more detail into the model, because again, what was coming out of the simulations was not quite matching what they believed was going to work. And then in the fourth meeting, we see this deflation. Like, suddenly nobody's talking, they're just asking a few questions about the model, and it kind of like fizzled out, okay? And this is another way of looking at that kind of discourse analysis. And here you see the content again: world, model, policy, process, and use. And which was, oh, this one's software. Somehow like that word was erased. But here it's like in response to model objections. So like, and the idea here was, why did we focus on model objection? Well, when you critique a model, is because you're starting to make comparisons to the real world, and what is it that comes after that is that matters. And so we were looking at, well, do they keep talking about the model? Do they talk about the world or the policy? And what kinds of interactions happen? And so we see here again, like meeting one, two, three, and four, we see a lot of richness in meeting two, but still very much focused on the model, some on the process. And here in meeting three, again, we see, oh, but there's really a lot more discussion around the world and policy. So there was, you know, this translation from the modeling work into the policy and the world. So, okay, we see again like that pattern of deflation, and we're like, okay, what are some possible explanations? So one of the explanations is that we started with simple interfaces with just a few, you know, levers to change and a few graphs to make sense of, to very detailed interfaces, which has a more geographically relevant landscape, but a lot more things to handle. So these are all parameters of that would determine scenarios, and a lot more graphs to make sense of. And so we went from also simple processes. This is just like, you know, a diagram. I'm not expecting you to read it, but, you know, just a simple diagram of the process of the first model, simple model that I showed you, to, you know, such a detailed process that it drowns the title of the slide, and I cannot even think of how to publish it. You know, I don't even know how to fit this in a paper. So what are some of the things that we learned from this first experience, or one of the first experience, which is, first of all, if you're going to work with stakeholders, you really have to keep the model simple. And it has to, I mean, the challenge for us as modelers is, well, it has to like navigate this tension between capturing the essential complexity so that it's still a valid model, but then simple enough that we can easily inspect it and manipulate it. Otherwise, it just becomes really unwieldy and incomprehensible. And part of it is because, again, like there was this clash between like what came out of the model, what they were expecting, it was hard to then explain that discrepancy because the model was so complicated. And then what also happened was, as there was that dissonance, they thought that the problem was that the model wasn't accurate, okay? And so, okay, you need to put more detail into it and more data into it. And it brought us further and further and further away from clarifying anything because it just became too complicated, okay? And so that was one of the biggest problems. So we thought, okay, we've got to allow them to access the simulation in a way that also helps them interact with this simpler model also, but in different ways. So we developed, and I'll show you in a little bit, some of these intermediate tangible user interfaces to help stakeholders who are not modelers interact with a simulation in more effective ways. Another very important lesson is that the way that we set it up as a progression of meetings and a progression of, you know, more models is that it was more of an instructional approach. And that's great for instruction, and so they learned, but it wasn't great for planning and decision making. It created a very weird dynamic in the group, and also this sense like we put all this time into it, and what did we really get out, and like in addition to like the fact that it was, you know, just all kind of complicated for them to make sense of, right? So we knew that we had to shift from this progression to something that was self-contained. So we still see it as an ongoing activity, but where each meeting, they get something out of it, and they can not come to another meeting and they're fine, they still got something out of it, okay? And so we moved to this, what we call opera style kind of, you know, workshop instead of like a more instructional one. And then we also had like these external partners in our project who were also stakeholders, the key stakeholders in the region. And they were suggesting, you know, why don't you start with something a little bit more visible than groundwater? Because groundwater is difficult to model and people don't see it and they don't necessarily connect to the problem itself. So, you know, we said, okay, we'll go to flooding. And so this is the second story. And I want to essentially illustrate. So this is a movie from a small landscape, urban landscape. So what is represented here is these are urban blocks, or suburban blocks actually. These dark gray are buildings. These are alleyways. These are streets with sewer intakes, and there's a sloping in this direction. And what this shows, and you see here a cross-section of the area, there's a big slope in towards the right and the lower corner of this very small area. This is based on this other model that I developed to investigate how green infrastructure mattered, like, you know, in space and how much we've got to put it to for it to be effective. So in this simulation, which that's the reference if you need it, let me know. But essentially what happens is that flooding occurs in this area, and there's all these basements that are in pink now get flooded. And so given that that's without any green infrastructure, if you were to have two competing scenarios, one where you have green barrels everywhere you can, which is in all the buildings, and the other where you have a few bioswales. Are people familiar with bioswales? No? Okay, so bioswales are essentially vegetated gardens, but they're engineered, so they have engineered soil, and therefore enhanced infiltration, so that, you know, as a stormwater management technique. And so from these two scenarios, we have two different kinds of outputs. So in the basin, of course, we don't have any installation cost, but we have, for one storm only, $39,000 in damages from, you know, these blocks over here. And 62% of the precipitation goes downstream to the neighborhood downstream, okay? When we have rain barrels, if we have rain barrels everywhere, we spend $14,000, and we don't really decrease damages by that much, and we don't decrease the outflow into the neighborhood downstream by much at all. If we have bioswales, they're much more expensive. This is the expense over 20 years, so it's actually not a fair comparison here. I know that, but just to give a sense of, like, it's $350,000 of like, present value of having bioswales in this area, but it does decrease the damages in one storm quite a bit. So if you think of 20 years of storm, it's going to be much more, and it does reduce also the runoff going downstream. So it's now 56% of the rain goes downstream instead of 62. So the question I always ask here is like, okay, which of these scenarios do you think is better?
Baseline.
Yeah, baseline, but you're not doing anything.
I know.
What kind of public official are you? Okay. Right. So anybody, who votes for rain barrels?
Conservation benefit.
Woo-hoo! Yeah, so there are some co-benefits that are here, right? So who votes for bioswales? Okay, so a lot of people are just very, well, I guess the others are just voting for baseline. Is that what it is? Okay. So they're ashamed. They don't want to vote. So the question that I always ask here is like, well, you know, what if I'm the public official and all I have is $15,000? What should I do? What if I'm, a hydrologist and I'm like, you know, I don't care. Like, we've got to infiltrate as much water as possible. What if I'm the resident living here in this corner? I'm like, you know, no matter what, I'm always screwed. I hate you all. Okay? So the thing is that, you know, there are trade-offs. Simulations alone are not going to give us answers. We all want to do the right thing, but what is right is different for different people. There are different costs, there are different benefits, and they're distributed. That's why we're always asking, for whom? Okay? What are we doing this for? Okay, or for whom are we doing this? So we've got utilities even, for example. So if we want to do green infrastructure, we would have to, and biosphere, we would have to dig, and you know, there's stuff under the ground, okay? So that adds to the cost of certain solutions. And again, who's going to pay for them? So we want to do the right thing. We have different ideas. And we can get a computer to crunch all the data in the world and do all the optimization and all of that. But the thing is that by the time it's done doing the data crunching, conditions might have changed. Values might have changed. And even then, even if nothing had changed, if I don't see what the computer is doing and the result doesn't align with what I believe, I don't trust what you're saying. So there's a lot of friction in that decision-making process. And so what are things that we can do to try to oil that so that there isn't that much or as much friction? We need to build the support for compromise, okay? So that means not just like thinking of what the solutions are, but what are we, who's winning, who's losing, and what do we do about that? And for that to happen, we have to know where we stand in terms of what our values are, and then also figure out what the values of other people are as we're trying to address diverse needs. So we've got to have the metrics in place that allow us to see those values and explore them. So still having the simulation, the complex system simulation, at the core of this, we developed these other interfaces to help access that simulation and try to visualize those trade-offs. So we started with this concern profile, and again, all of these things are built with stakeholders, okay, to make sure that it's relevant to them, that it makes sense, that it's transparent, etc. And we had different kinds of experts, from community experts to hydrological experts, all of them, you know, involved in the development of this over time. And so, for example, here is a concern profile. Like every participant in around the simulation has an iPad. In this iPad, they are faced, you know, they're presented with this concern profile where they can prioritize what are their concerns. So as a hydrologist, I would put like all the flooding, all the hydrological stuff up top. But if I'm a public official, I might put investment and damage reduction up top. And if I'm a resident, I'll put, you know, other things on top. Okay, and I'll rank these differently. And what this does is that it gives a different weight to each one of these variables, and it's gonna be used later. So there's also a paper map that represents the landscape, the neighborhood that we're all working around. And we've built these different tokens representing different kinds of green infrastructure that then people around the table can together create scenarios with. So that then, we have the iPad take a picture of that, becomes a scenario, it builds into the simulation. The simulation runs in a couple of minutes, and it downloads, sorry, this is like the picture of like people working together on a scenario. And it downloads it into the iPad, and each one of the rows here is a scenario that they tried. So here's all rain barrels, and this must be the hydrologist because they don't like it at all. It doesn't do much, you know, in terms of hydrology. And this is like roof gardens, and this is bioswales, and of course they love it, okay? But they can, you know, scroll to the right and see other kinds of variables. So this is the variables that they care about the most. But the other thing that the iPad has is that they can actually also compare their evaluation to the evaluation of other participants in the group. And so this set of bars here is for the pedestrian and the policymaker in the group and how they like the rain barrels. And the pedestrian, of course, hates it, doesn't like it at all, because it doesn't do anything for flooding. But the policymaker loves it because it's really cheap. Okay? And this, what this allows is to say, like, okay, in the landscape of scenarios, these two don't seem to work very well for us. Let's focus on these ones. And now we can have discussions about, okay, here you win, I lose, here I win, you lose. You know, what do we do? Do we go for something that is more equitable? Do we go for something where you win a lot, but then you can compensate me? Maybe this means that you guys pay more taxes and then can support this decision and so on. So that discussion can happen. And then that feeds back into, with the understanding of the simulation in terms of how water flows through the system and also the values, it can go back to creating new scenarios together they can try out, or even reshuffling their priorities when they understand where people are coming from. So what we see is like that there's learning, innovation, and compromise happening. The assumptions are transparent, people engage in systematic exploration. There's a lot of gesturing and mental modeling involved. So again, like, they can anticipate how water flows through the landscape. They can imagine different performance even without running the simulation. And then again, getting to that point where realizing that what they thought was going to work wasn't going to work. But the difference here is that they could really start thinking of other things outside the box, because they had a clearer vision of what was going on in the system, both biophysically and socially. And so, okay, perhaps we need to move things out of here. We have to combine green and gray infrastructure. We've got to coordinate with other communities. One thing that I want to emphasize here is all of this takes time. It's collaborative design. We're working with stakeholders to create tools with them, again, not for them. Facilitation in all of these processes was key. So it's not just about the tools, but how do we use them? And how do we help participants use these tools? The emphasis, and shifting the emphasis from consensus to compromise, because it's about not just, you know, the best solution, but what is a good enough solution that we can all live with, okay? It's a different kind of exploration and question and answer. And it's about what's the give and take? What do we give up? Who gives it up, and what do we do about it? So we see this as a scaffolding process of the modeling, as a point of entry to the problem, to other tools that might be more accurate, that would be interesting to include, to diverse interests, and to other kinds of complex problems as well, so not just flooding, but other things. I'll skip this because I think we're running out of time. I'll include this in other conversations when we talk about this. And this is the last slide. So why do we do this? Why do I think we should do this? First of all, on a personal note, I have small children. And I am concerned. And I think that there are things that we really need to do, like yesterday, okay, to get things done. And I think that there's a possibility here in these kinds of groups to think about the heuristics, that the way that we do things right now that really keep us from really innovating and changing the way things are. Okay, and we can move away from that by creating tools and approaches that support both the evolution of understanding of, like, the biophysical processes, but also the valuation. What are our different preferences? What are our different values? How do we bring these together? How do we acknowledge everybody's position, everybody's needs and wants, but, you know, in a way that really we all, you know, we figure out what we do together, okay? So here, technology is not, again, a replacement for human judgment, but it's a prosthetic device that can support innovation and exploration evaluation together. And this is what really brings innovation, and that's what is critical for resilience and sustainability. I always give credit where credit is due. I didn't work alone. I worked with a lot of people. And I always put this up. But thank you. That's it. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you, Moira. Because of time, I think we'll go with one question. Charles?
So you didn't have observational data as part of the exercise. And I guess some of the individuals who didn't believe the model, I think observational data would have gone along, if your model would have been able to do something, to reproduce some features that is observed.
Well, we did, actually. We did reproduce the fact that there was drawdown, and there was drawdown.
And was there observations of that?
Yeah, there was. Model? And there was some data, perhaps at that time, and there definitely with flooding there was as well, right? So, but in the flooding, I think that it was, again, like a more visible, even without the measurements, it was more visible for people. For groundwater, it wasn't. And I think that was part of the problem. Even if I had shown them the data and the data was there, it was still, there were all these other issues that were going on. On one hand, the problem not being as visible, but on the other hand, like the way that we approached it, that, you know, we learned was not as effective. It was effective for learning, but not for decision making and for planning. But there was observational data.
Because yeah. The setting looks made up, but you're saying that there was really attached to some real...
No, it was a real geography.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, it definitely was a real geography. I mean, to you, probably didn't look like it,
right,
but for the people there, you know, we could say, like, these are these towns, these are these other towns. So, yeah, no, it definitely was geographically relevant. And we wanted to do that so that to increase the trust in it. But again, there were all these other things going on that really prevented that from coming through. Yeah.
Okay, thanks. Thanks very much.
Okay.
I think you'll be integrating some of your presentation.
Yes, absolutely.